so deeply. Everything with Rav Lichtenstein was complex and subtle and nuanced. There was never a yes or no answer. And I think one of his great gifts is he taught us that life is complex and you should avoid simplicity and its shades of gray, and answers shouldn't just be knee-jerk, reflexive, wholesale condemnations or endorsements, but there are always dangers and advantages, and to parse our life and parse experiences and deconstruct them rather than just, today we live in a world of flag-waving and hardened, fossilized radical politics. You're either left, you're right. If you're left, you're expected to believe in these values, right, believe in those values, rather than just saying, choose issues, assess them, and realize that everything is balanced. And because of this, every speech of his was very panoramic. It was never just about one issue. People sometimes ask me, how come I quote Rav Amital so often, and I rarely quote Rav Lichtenstein? And I say Rav Lichtenstein is unquotable, because he addressed a particular object, but he used that as a fulcrum or as a prism to basically address, you felt, the only way I can explain is you felt that in every Shia he was building the totality of what religious identity is, but from a different angle. So if he was talking about humanism, he wasn't talking about humanism, he just spread his wings so far, he was talking about religion and HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our relationship through the prism of humanism. And the next day he spoke about Ahava and Yira, and he spoke about Avodas Hashem in the broad sweeping sense through the prism of Ahava and Yira. I remember he used to speak Friday night, minimum for an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Minimum. And during the summer,
when did he speak at the doctor?
Between Kabbal Shabbos and Maariv.
Oh my gosh.
And we'd make Kiddush. My family would make Kiddush at 10:30 at night because they'd wait for me. And my wife would ask me, what did Rav Aaron speak about tonight? And I said, he said Moshe was a good person. My wife would look at me, it took an hour and a half, but it was never just what's good and what are the different forms of good and divine good and human good and the dangers of good and evil and paradise good and ideal. And you felt as if there's panoramic, he was building you block by block, brick by brick, building this religious edifice every time you heard a shiur. Those were the shiur. The essays were even more complex and panoramic. That's why the essays are so hard to read. And if you're not accustomed to reading the essays, good luck. It's tough sledding. Now, what I'd like to discuss today is not a speech, nor is it an essay. It's actually a thesis. It's the closest word I can. In the late 60s, Rav Lichtenstein was involved in a think tank under the auspices of YU. And the agenda or the program of this think tank was to start to analyze broader values through the prism of halacha, right up Rav Lichtenstein's alley. And he wrote 6 or 7 of these large, major 100-page theses about these large topics, and that book has recently been published, Values in Halacha. Now, good luck reading it. It took me around four runs to read this article just to get some sense of a bird's eye view of what the article is talking about. But I would say I started
a couple weeks ago, but to be more accurate, to say I tried to start.
No, it's hard. It's really rough sledding. First of all, it's written in the late 60s, so all the reference points are 30s, 40s, 50s thinkers, people that we haven't heard of, and they're not part of our parlance. And of course, he sat down. He wasn't just writing off the cuff. He was investigating and exploring and collecting information. It wasn't seen at his academic best, and just it's just so fulsome and so expansive. But I just wanted to give you a sense of what he was discussing. He tackled the following issue. Is religion, when he says religion, we mean Yiddishkeit, Judaism, is it consistent with humanism? And what is humanism? It's a hard thing to define, but let's just put a simple working definition out there. Humanism is a view of this world which values the human being. We'll try to delineate that and sharpen it. Now, most people would either give a yes or a no answer to that question, if you ask them that question. And by the way, most people would say no. Because certainly historically, humanism, secular humanism, has replaced classic religion. Humanism begins in the 14th and 15th century, highly values human beings. We'll talk about what that led to. And ironically, it has biblical roots. The forerunners of that movement are quoting the Bible and quoting Salam Elohim and actually quoting Midrashim. But then in the 18th century, with enlightenment, political freedom, and then the 19th century with free thinking, freedom of conscience, not just freedom of politics, so this whole movement shifts massively away from God, religion, to utopian politics, utilitarian politics. Some of you have heard of Harvey Cox, A Secular City, and some of the major writers that we've moved away from God. We no longer need God because we've celebrated the potential of human beings. What's his name? Who's that crazy Israeli that everyone Harari? Yeah. He's probably a modern expression of that. Kanzler is very bright, very quick-witted, transhumanism, we can advance to the next day. So he's a modern-day secular humanist, if you're looking for a modern tag. But for Lichtenstein, of course, it's not yes or no. And in this subtlety, he drills down, deconstructs humanism, deconstructs Judaism, and even if you're not interested in humanism, all of a sudden you've got 15 ideas to be a better Ovid Hashem. And it just it ended up being that way. He wasn't discussing a topic. Sometimes his punchline is very flat. Like when he talks about human morality versus divine morality, that kid issue. So Rav Amital's discussion is riveting. Rav Aaron's punchline is two sentences and it's flat. But the entire encasement is 40 pages of discussing the Kodesh Baruch Hu and the Tzuva V'Yoseh and commandments and human morality and human integrity. So you just feel like there's this tapestry of Jewish ideas that are unfolded every time a particular issue is addressed. Even if the conversation tends to veer far, far afield. So let's start. Is humanism consistent with, as we call it, Yiddishkeit, Judaism, religion? In order to better handle this, we're looking to see, classic Brisker style, split it into two questions. Question number one, how do we view the nature of man? How does humanism or humanistically influenced thinkers, how do they view the nature of man in the cosmos, in the universe? What is man's nature? Number two, how does this affect our experience, our day-to-day experience? By the way, the experience will itself split into six or seven different issues. But right now, these are the two mind spaces that he's carving out. And by and large, spoiler alert, when it comes to the nature of human beings, there's a lot of overlap between humanistic thinking and Judaism. When it comes to the experience, it's a little bit more subtle. It's a little bit more diverse. Okay, so two totally separate questions. How do we view man by nature? What is the nature of man? So, of course, in classic humanist thought, man is an exquisite creature, gifted with a divine essence that other creatures aren't endowed with. Whatever that divine essence is, it could be creativity, intellect, consciousness, freedom of consciousness, free will, cognitive speech, emotions, whatever we have that a dog doesn't have, whatever we have that a whale doesn't have, this is our Tzelem Elokim. We are an exquisite creature. We were gifted. And not only that, we're the pinnacle of creation, toward which creation is meant to support. Hashem created this world to support human endeavor so that human beings can then find a Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's classic humanist thought. And not surprisingly, this is all taken because the humanists themselves drew it from the following sources. I mean, I'm just quoting Rebbe Chassin's sources. Obviously, they had their own. Source number one, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, Rabbi Akiva, Sviras Omer. Rabbi Akiva lived right at the time where religion was starting to, this is me speaking now, was starting to transform. This is the shift from paganism to monotheism, right around Christianity. Rabbi Akiva is born, I would say probably, if he lives to be 120 years, he dies 136, he's born in the year 15. So this is an environment that's rife with religious thought. So all of his conversations tend to be theological. His conversations with Tunis Rufus are very theological. He asks him, are Hashem's creatures better than human creatures? They're questioning Bris Milah, they're questioning Schar Vionesh, reward and punishment. Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, to a degree of Beinu HaKadosh, in his conversations with Antoninus. It's a lot of theology. You don't have this with Hillel. Hillel doesn't have theological conversations because they're still Greek Hellenists. They're not yet close to monotheism. But the Romans were studying Christianity in the 4th century. They adopt Christianity. So they're interested in what the Jews have to say about religion. So this is one of Rabbi Akiva's famous statements. You have to Echa Kamocha, Chababim Shenivra B'Tzelem. Or source number two, the Medrash, Amar Malachai Asheres HaVeh Kodesh Baruch Hu, Lama Nivru Migdal Mali Kol Tov. Why did you build this beautiful fortress, look outside, beautiful edifice. And yet, Ein Lo Archim, there's no one to enjoy. Namely, before you create man, all of your creation, with all of its beauty and all of its symmetry and all of its bounty, is purposeless. Before day six, creation is still vacant because there's no one to enjoy because creation is meant to serve man. So certainly if you ask what is the nature of man, Judaism more or less is identical with humanistic thought with two caveats. And these are the two caveats that help us better drill down to what our Kodesh Baruch Hu's expectations are of us. Number one, caveat number one, there's an antinomy. It's Rav Lichtenstein's word. An easier word is a dichotomy. There's a dichotomy within human identity. We're not just exquisite and grand, lofty and noble, but we're weak and fragile, vulnerable, and we can fail. And it's up to us to decide who we'll be like. And classic secular humanism, that darker side of man, that weaker side of man, isn't as stressed. Man is exquisite and almost like inalienable and unfallible. So, for example, to quote this, Rav Lichtenstein, just before I get to quote number three, and this is the voice of Koheles, source number four. Ki mikra b'nei adam, mikra b'heim, mikra echad lahem, ruach echad lahem, ruach echad lahem, mina b'heim ayin, ki kohevel. As lofty and angelic as humans are, they're also moser ha'adam, mina b'heim ayin, ki kohevel. They're less than animals. Okay? This duality is conveyed by a well-known medrash. It's actually, ironically, a parashas Tezriya Metzora medrash, because if you're following Sefer Vayikra, the laws of animals precede the laws of man. So the laws of animals are discussed at the end of Shemini, and the laws of man, childbirth, Isha Ki Tezriya, are discussed. And Chazal noticed this sequencing, and the sequencing is the inverse of, let's say, Bereishis Beis, where man is created first. So for Chazal, very famous matter, source number 3, Im Zacha Adam Omrim Lo, Atak Adam Tala Malach Esharis. If a man is righteous and meritorious and deserves it, you appear in Bereishis even before, not just in Bereishis Beis, but in Bereishis Aleph. Ruach Elokim Rachevis Al Pnei Amayim, Chazal say that's Mashiach. Ruach Elokim is Mashiach. So man at his ideal precedes all of creation. Whereas man at his weak stage, okay, if you fail, line number 2, source 3, Im Lav Armim Lo, Zavuv Kadamcha, an insect came before you, Yitrish Kadamcha, a maggot came before you, Shilshozek Kadamcha, possibly defecation came before you, whatever Shilshul may mean, not necessarily the modern Shilshul, but probably snail. So this duality is one of the Lichtenstein's caveats. The man is not just lofty, he can also be flawed and blemished. Number 2, and more importantly, man's exquisite and lofty nature isn't inherent, but it's gifted to him by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And because it's gifted to him by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, it is accompanied by expectations, obligations, mission, responsibility. And that's, now me speaking, that's really, I think, one of the intersections that Rav Lichtenstein makes one term and secular humanism takes another term. Because secular humanism recognizes man's exquisite nature without any responsibilities. And therefore, the path to self-indulgence and hedonism, self-experience, and self-actualization is open. Whereas once your lofty title and stature is divinely endowed, then it comes with expectations. And that, in two words, is what we call Godless Adam, the famous Slabodka approach, that man is great, man is mighty, man is endowed with princely nature, and therefore, pasnish for you to fail, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, pasnish for you to fail your expectations. Rav Lichtenstein, and his eye was so keen, because he had a literary background, he read texts so subtly, he saw this in the Nusach HaTfilah of Ne'ilah. In Ne'ilah, we have a shortened vidui towards the end, Chazaras HaShatz, but there's a preface to the vidui which doesn't appear in the other tefillahs. Source number 5. Manu, machayenu, machasdenu, makochenu. We all know this. Futility, self-abnegation, self-denial. Kikol maseitahu, vimei hechayen hevelefanecha, umosa harda mina behema oyin, kekol havel. And then, atavdalta enosh mirosh vatkirer lemod lefanecha. Despite the futility and the Koheles-like nature of man, kekol havel, you selected us to stand in front of you, to serve you, to advance your mission, to advance your agenda. Or if we go back to Tehillim Parakas, Parakas is the parak that distills these two poles of human experience. Kira shenacha maseetz bosecha, I look at your world, I look at your universe, manosh, what is man? He's nothing. Vatakireo, but yet, source number 6, vatakireo, vatachazra meat melokim, vakovet vatatafreo. Even though man is nothing, manosh kitiskereno, vatakireo. You acknowledge man, you endowed man with gifts, you raise man's station, and with that comes responsibilities. Now, I wanted to bring Rav Lichtenstein's voice into the shir, so there are a lot of quotes. It took a lot of time for me to parse these quotes, because, as he said, this is not easy reading. But I wanted his voice to be heard in today's conversation. So source number 7 is a quote, from a religious perspective, however, regards mankind as having not only rights, but responsibilities. I'm just going to select from this. Energies which may have been channeled toward the advancement of purely human welfare are expended in the service of God. Source number 8, with the page selections, is God who invests human life with meaning. So those are the two caveats. God invests us with meaning, therefore the responsibilities, and B, man can fail and surrender or forfeit his lofty stature. Okay? That's more or less the first and smaller of the two elements. The nature of man, there is an overlap in the way halacha or the way Judaism views man and the way humanism views man, with the two caveats that it's a dichotomy and that it's divinely installed with responsibility. Interestingly enough, because for Rav Lichtenstein, halacha was always the yardstick, and he was the quintessential halachic man, and you'll see this later. Halacha, which ironically steals some of our sovereignty, we'll see later, I'm not free to do what I'd like today, I'm halachically obliged to follow certain commandments, on the same token, it's predicated upon human freedom, because halacha is a choice, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gifts us and gives us that choice. So Rav Lichtenstein saw, I don't know that many would agree with this, but for Rav Lichtenstein, the system of halacha, not necessarily the day-to-day application, but the system of halacha is a celebration of the unique status of man. No other creature has halacha because no other creature has freedom of choice. We were gifted with freedom of choice, and therefore halacha is a celebration, and you can hear his voice. Those of you who have heard Rav Lichtenstein, read him, just listen to this quote, and he's literally in the room. Source number 9. As a normative system, it is grounded upon one cardinal premise. That's his classic word, cardinal. Who uses it? Human freedom and creativity. It trumpets forth, in turn, one central message. Human freedom and creativity. Bottom of first page. Does not merely posit this doctrine as a metaphysical principle. It envisions freedom at every level. It makes one persistent demand. Choose! Decide! Halacha posits Jewish existence at the plane of maximal consciousness and decision. The Jew is insistently called upon to exercise intelligence and rational will. To act as an active subject rather than a passive object. Those of you remember, a gavra, not a chefzer, of course, enjoyed superimposing the halachic dichotomy onto human identity. Are you a gavra or are you a chefzer? Are you making decisions or are you just following the herd, following social pressures, following internal instincts? So this is Rav Lichtenstein's first. Welcome. What's your name?
Michal.
Michal, welcome. This is Rav Lichtenstein's first field of study. How does humanism view man? How does the Kodesh Baruch Hu, how does halacha view man? The more tricky part is experience. What about when we shift from theory to practice? How is our day-to-day religious experience infused or countered by humanistic values? So, first of all, Rav Aaron suggested that some would claim that there's a relationship between part A and part B. The more you see man as exquisite and cardinal and the pinnacle of creation, the less otherworldly you'd be, the more you'd see that life on this planet should be geared towards maximal enjoyment, maximal pleasure, maximal human welfare, not hedonistic, not in a degenerate way, but you'd be less otherworldly. You'd be more focused on the needs and the welfare of human beings in this world. The less you rank and rate man, the more otherworldly you'd be. Man is futile, man is meaningless, man is a worm, and our only salvation is the next world and eternity. You would think that to be true. It's not always true, Rav Aaron noted. So, for example, he took the idea of Navardak. Navardak was one of the great Musar yeshivas in Europe. It celebrated the primacy of man, but yet it encouraged a very ascetic, self-depriving, self-flagellating experience. So just because you value man in theory doesn't mean that you apply that value in practice. You may shift and say, well, I value man, but because I value man, he has to live a much more disciplined life. So, Caesar, I'm just still recovering from a cold. Source number 10. In a sense, of course, the two problems are related. Insofar as one assumes the majesty and dignity of man, he presumably becomes less prone to otherworldliness. You would think the two are correlated. But, source 11, they're not true. Take a recent Jewish example. Navardak, the school of Musar, entertained the most exalted conceptions of man's intrinsic worth, and yet counseled radical forms of asceticism and renunciation. So in theory, you could split the two questions. You can believe and regard man highly, but not necessarily indulge in his welfare. Of course, Rav Lichtenstein, those that know him know that he's not going to be taking an Avaritic approach. That's certainly not his approach. And he's going to campaign in favor of halacha being sensitive to human welfare. And here's where I think this article begins to shine. Part 2 and Part 3, or Part 2 and Part 2, 2A and 2B. Number one, Rav Lichtenstein is going to say 2A. Before I get to specific halachic expressions, religion in general, forget this halacha, that exception, halacha, general halachic system, general avodas Hashem, not just the conception of man, but we're commanded to a system called halacha. Is that humanistic or not? Answer, he's going to say yes, with one major difference. Then amazingly, he's going to start, and this shir is going to change very quickly from a conversation to a shir klali, he's going to bring 6 examples of where humanistic concerns participate internally in halacha calculus. So 2A is, part one is the nature of man. Part two is religious experience. But religious experience has 2 parts to it. One is in general. You'll see what I mean in general. Number two is, give me specific examples. Okay, so 2A is, how do we make sense of religious experience? Does it sound humanistic to us? And if so, where does it express itself? Rav Lichtenstein itemized 3 areas that he thought were reflections of symmetry between halacha and between humanistic instincts or inclinations. One is chesed. If man weren't regarded that highly, and his welfare and prosperity and comfort weren't important. Why such an emphasis on chesed? Why v'yavtarecha kamocha? Why is chesed such a primary? And of course, there are many layers to chesed. There's a matatziel day to cover our own moral personality and to improve ourselves. But Rabbi Chassin, I remember I once gave an interview about 30 years ago to a student. I walked into a town, an out-of-town location, and I had like 10 interviews. So the principal had rachmanis on me. And he said, here, let me help you. This boy, valedictorian, great kid, he gets in. You don't have to worry about it. Move on to the others. You can get in. I said, no, everyone gets a fair shot. No one gets in free. So I asked the kid, after he finished reading the Gemara backwards and forwards for me, I said, tell me, did you do any chesed in your life? Which is a classic question. He said, yes. I said, why? Now, there are 999 right answers to that. He gave the one wrong answer. He said, you know, my thank God I had a very comfortable upbringing. My parents are wealthy. I never really had any distress. Who knows? Fortunes change. One day I may be poor. I may have needs. It's only reasonable that I contribute now. Say, what are you, a chesed bank? The bank's open for cheseds. That's why you do chesed, because you're investing in your future recovery. It was just so off. And I told the principal, I said, nothing against him, but we're not the yeshiva for him. He needs a moral overhaul. He needs people to look into his neshama and help him. I mean, the first reason you do chesed is because you care about human suffering, and you see someone suffering, you feel compassion, you feel heartache, you feel their sadness, and you do your best. Even if you can't, you sympathize, identify. I mean, talk a little bit later about Rabbi Chassin's compassion. So why would the Torah stress chesed so deeply? So this is quote 12. It doesn't really convey it, but I wanted to include the quote. This spirit is rooted in the spirit of chesed, in an awareness of the significance of man's temporal needs, physical as well as psychological. If we just dismiss man's needs and we're just here to serve some other purpose and we're just cogs in some larger machinery, why would there be such an emphasis? Remember, we take chesed for granted, A, because we're Jews, B, because we have Jewishized the whole world. And Christianity adopted chesed as its pole, as its lodestar. In Greece, there's no chesed. This is our major innovation. In the world of ancient Greek philosophy, there's hospitality, friendship. There are many areas of human interaction, of kindness, but they're not described as charity. People that are destitute or indigent, you're not expected to support them. They're the weak links in the chain. Sounds almost eugenistic, but so our introduction, again, Christianity has almost stolen that agenda from us because they've eliminated ritual, they've turned it into a religion of love and charity, which thank God. But we don't realize how revolutionary charity and chesed is in the broader sweep of human consciousness, or just consciousness. The second aspect which Rabbi Chassin reflected the humanistic strain is the total absence of any ascetic, self-renunciating, which in 2 days everyone has to eat, you're not allowed to fast on Shabbos, and you're not meant to be celibate, and we don't encourage complete self-denial and self-deprivation. We want to embrace this world and experience this world, and of course we'll see in a moment, sanctify this world. Rav Aaron would always quote this Gemara. He'd love this Gemara. Source number 14, the Nazir has to bring a Karban Chatas. And the simple interpretation of why the Nazir brings a Karban Chatas is because he brings it after he becomes Tamei and violates his Naziris. But Rav Lezer Akapo felt that the Karban Chatas was not to atone for the violation, source 14, for the violation of the Karban, of the Naziris, excuse me, but the actual Naziris is altering this very delicate calibration between deprivation and engagement. So on the one hand, we don't endorse indulgence, and then we don't endorse asceticism. Hashem creates a very carefully calibrated interaction with this world, when we should eat, what we should eat, and by adding extra items that are usher, the nazir, beyond just the Isriyayin, is upsetting and undoing this carefully stitched fabric of engagement that Hashem created. A very famous Gemara Bava Kamma appears several times, Shetziyatz from Minayayin. And of course, the Rambam adopted this and he editorialized about the Nazir's larger sin, not the failure of the Naziris, but the actual adoption of the Naziris. just to show Rav Lichtenstein's dexterity of text, because he was very, very, I mean, he would sometimes read Gemaras for us in ways that we just completely didn't anticipate. Sometimes I hear people quoting a Gemara, and they quote it as a one-dimensional Gemara, as if that's the truth of Yiddishkeit. And some of these Gemaras are so flexible, they can mean so many different things. I'm not going to give examples because we spent 2 hours here. But the Gemara says, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, when he died, and he was known for his midos. Part of the reason the Mishnah became so authoritative is because he combined 6 or 7 traits that hadn't ever been combined before. He came from pedigree. He came from Hillel. And he had the Masara that he learned from the Kivas Talmidim. And he was wealthy. And there was a period of detente between the Jews and the Romans. And he had great midos. And he was dexterous of language. And he's just sort of like a cocktail, a perfect storm of different traits that made the Mishnah authoritative. Remember, at the end of the day, revolutionary svarim that are written only become authoritative if Am Yisrael accepts it. Shulchan Aruch wasn't accepted for about 100 years. In 1570, not everyone accepted the Shulchan Aruch. By 1700, it's the Shulchan Aruch. Similar process with the Mishnah. People accepted it because he's a saintly figure. Why was he called Rabbeinu HaKadosh? Like we call Rabbi Soloveitchik the Rav, or Maran, Rabbi Yosef. He was just so transcendent, so surpassing that people, even in his lifetime, recognized his stature. So when he died, and of course, there's an iconic deathbed scene, as there always is with people of his stature, he raises his 10 fingers to heaven, he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I never received any hana through these 10 fingers. So the simple way to read it is that Rebbe was the classic ascetic, and he didn't engage in this world, and that's the route that Tosfos takes. Source 17, Lo Nanesa Afilu Be'etz Paktana, Damrina B'medesh, and Tosfos is quoting a medesh to support his view of this Gemara, Acha Adam Espalo Shikan Yistarot Tach Gufa, while you're davening, the Torah should be absorbed. Yispal Shiloi comes to Madanam Tach Gufa. You should also daven, the tuna fish that you just ate shouldn't really be absorbed, you just need to eat it, but you don't want to enjoy the tuna fish. That's Tosfos' read of Rebbe. But if you read Rashi, Rashi has a completely different view. Source number 16. He's basically quoting Shmuel. I never got a salary. I wasn't corrupt. I didn't skim any money. I was an honest and moral leader. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I didn't steal money. It's not that he didn't enjoy. Remember, Rebbe, source number 8, I won't read it. This is the same Rebbe who was friendly with Antoninus, who I'll put into our jargon, even in the winter he had pineapple on his table. I remember when I was growing up in Brooklyn, we couldn't get pineapples in the window because they still airlifted them from Puerto Rico. You probably get them today. But Rebbe, this was before airlifting, he never had a situation where there weren't radishes or summer fruit on his table. So that doesn't sound like an ascetic to me, unless he put it on his table for the guests, but he refused to eat it. So Rebbe, according to at least Rashi, for a Lichtenstein, was this exemplar of this very delicate balance between engagement and non-engagement. The Nazir violates that balance. So the first indicator that humanism influences religious experience in general is chesed. The second one is the avoidance of asceticism and self-abnegation. The third one is the fact that we don't just tolerate the physical world and we don't just engage in the physical world, but we see it as an arena and as an aspect for religious experience. When we eat, it's a mitzvah. When we make a Seudas mitzvah, we see the physical world. Now, in classic style, Rav Lichtenstein quoted this beautiful quote by this author called R.H. Tawney. Don't ask me who it is. I wikied him, so I know who it is, but I've never heard of him before. Some of the others I'd heard of before, but this person, never. He was an economic historian of the late 19th century. Evidently, which is fascinating, probably guess is Ayn Rand, and that Harvey Cox, that whole group of people, as capitalism is becoming culturally influential, people were questioning the relationship between capitalism and religion. Like, what are the religious messages behind capitalism? So here's one of those authors. I think the origin of capitalism, the origins of religion, there's some book you can look it up, but Rav Aaron enjoyed reading him, especially, again, I don't think it was his go-to author, but in 1968 he was preparing this expose or this thesis, so he was rigorous in his research. So Tawney writes, source number 19, and of course Lichtenstein is going to adopt Tawney, but expand on him. Tawney writes, may at once accept and criticize, tolerate and amend, welcome, here's the punchline, welcome the gross world of human appetites, it's a gross world spiritually of human appetites, as the squalid scaffolding from amid which the life of spirit must rise. Beautiful phrase. The squalid scaffolding. You look outside, the squalid scaffolding. So here it's not a metal scaffolding, but it's a material scaffolding of our spirit. Our spirit has to rise, and the squalid scaffolding, which we don't reject, but we endorse. So, of course, Rav Lichtenstein is going to step in and not make fun of Tawney, but it's only a squalid scaffolding. The classic, Elie Weber has this line, because when you went to Rav Lichtenstein and you asked him a question, you were always unnerved, you were always uncomfortable, you never learned with him. You felt you were in the presence of an angel, a Vilna Gaon, someone from a different world. You're always uncomfortable. You couldn't imagine who you were standing in front of. And you would ask him, so Rebbe, what do you think about the latest political situation in Israel? Say, well, political situation, and he'd say something, and you'd be so nervous that the only thing you could do was a nervous laugh. You couldn't respond. You hyperventilated. So you go, just to laugh. And he would always respond to you, you laugh. And we never were laughing. It was, no, Rebbe, I'm not laughing at you. I'm hyperventilating. It's the only voice that comes out. You go, you laugh. They would go on to explain. So I hear his voice. It's a squalid scaffolding. The halacha does not, and this is now Rav Lichtenstein, the end of source 19, does not merely regard the mundane order as squalid scaffolding for which spiritual life may emerge. Okay, Tony, don't, this Tony, who's just writing a nice, all of a sudden Tony becomes public enemy number one. Squalid scaffolding, of course not. It's more than that. The mundane is itself one facet of spiritual life, not just an arena, but the very fabric of living. So these are the three components through which we see humanism peeking out at us through religious experience in general. Chesed, lack of asceticism, and as we call it, Kiddusha. Mekadesh Nesachol. However, here you see Rav Aaron's subtle, gray nuancing. However, even though we hear humanism and see humanism peeking out at us from religious experience, there's still one major difference. And these are my words, but they're Rav Aaron's words, but I want to put them into powerful, succinct form. Asceticism, no. Sacrifice, yes. And halacha demands every sacrifice. And that's where the shift from passive humanism is. The entire halacha experience, predicated as it is on freedom, predicated as it is on the grandeur of man, predicated as it is on Kadosh Baruch Hu demands that we sacrifice. Rav Lichtenstein says Eved Hashem, which we'll talk about for a little time later on. And just how carefully he read Gemaras. He took a Gemara which seems humanistic, but he framed it within a non-humanistic sacrifice context. Very often the Gemara will say that the Torah went cheap on us because it was worried about additional expenditures of money. We call it chasa rachmano monish yisrael. Don't spend too much because Hashem cares for your money. That's a very humanistic statement. Hashem wants me to have more money, more welfare, more means. But every time the Gemara applies that concept, it applies it within a context of a carbon in which we're spending a lot of money anyway. And the Torah is just saying, okay, you're spending a lot of money, we'll give you a little 5% discount. So, for example, the two Gemaras. It doesn't occur anywhere else. I mean, you have to know Shas to see this. So it's number 20. On Yom Kippur, so instead of using a fire pan of silver, the gold, silver is a fire pan of gold. My taima, chasar lona. The rest of the year, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know what? You don't have to bring a gold when you're spending a lot of money for a silver fire pan. Or we bring a karbon shnei lechem so we can buy chitim from the shuk. We don't have to buy solas, which would be more expensive. We're still purchasing a lot. So in the context of a karbon and a sacrifice, which demands of human liberty, which diverts human liberty, which diverts human resources, Hashem introduces an allowance or a discount, but doesn't mean that you're avoiding the sacrifice. And just to summarize, clearly, if the halacha, source number 22, rejects outright asceticism, it is no hesitation about demanding personal sacrifice. Halacha shifts the center of authority from man to law. Halacha. On the one hand, man is no longer vested with the power of ultimate decision. Human comfort is discarded as the normal ground of decision. Right? We all make decisions based on human comfort. We make decisions based on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, based on his Ratzon. And not only is human comfort a human freedom obliterated by halacha, because we submit to halacha, but human judgment. When Moshe, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls Avram up to Har Moriah, not only is Avram tasked with submitting human decision to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, okay, I'll do it, but it's against his moral instincts. So he has to suspend moral instincts, not just moral human decision. So halacha demands sacrificing not just our actions, but sacrificing our moral judgment. Source number 23, the sacrifice it requires in principle is not only natural inclination, but moral judgment proper. As Kierkegaard so clearly perceived, the Akedah involved Avram's ethical instincts as well as his son. That's a fancy way of saying Avram was on the Mizbeach also. Yitzchak was physically on the Mizbeach, but Avram's moral conscience was being sacrificed for his act, and he fought so hard to develop his moral conscience. To summarize, source 24, this is a nice way to wrap up part 2a. This is Rav Lichtenstein. It is almost ludicrous to speak of Judaism as an anthropocentric religion. Judaism is humanistic in its vision of man's worth, nature, its concern with his well-being, and its positive approach to all aspects, namely man's worth, chesed, and embracing mundane experiences. But it harbors no illusions about a man's servile position. He's an eved, a position he occupies not as a punishment for some original sin. We're not downgraded because of chet. So all of a sudden we were mighty and angelic, we were downgraded. It's a very Christian idea. But simply as a natural condition or the result of a covenantal commitment. Namely, it's our natural state, we're an Eved Hashem, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a bris into which we enter that office. And with this ends part 2. Part 3 is a little bit more concrete, don't worry. But you see how this issue, which you and I would answer in 20 seconds, becomes a pedestal for broad and sweeping religious inquiry about the nature of man, and the nature of halacha, and the nature of chesed, and everything was everything. There was no moment in which you didn't feel like you were sitting at a board table five times the size of this boardroom and just discussing all of Yiddishkeit and all of Avodas Hashem, and everything came into the conversation. You didn't know where it was coming next. These were not small conversations. These were large, majestic tour de forces that just drilled down into your identity and built religious identity. You're just building you through these conversations. They weren't telescopic or tangential conversations about a particular issue. The third part, or 2B, is Rav Lichtenstein at his best. Rav Lichtenstein starts to play halachic man. Halachic man, the premise is that halachic data should be the platform for theological speculation. So instead of you and me, it's another saying, let's have some coffee and think about what Hashem wants from me, or what Hashem's view of marriage is. Or let's learn Kiddushin five times, briskerize and atomize all the details of Maseches Kiddushin. And then once we get to a gather of what Kiddushin is, then think about what that means conceptually. Or if you and I want to talk about what's the nature of the judicial system, so let's learn Sanhedrin backwards and forwards for 10 years. Then when we're finished, we have all the halachic data atomized and organized. Atomizing means you take large concepts and you break it down to an atomic idea. What is the idea? What is the gather? Brisker is atomization. You take large ideas and you define them clearly and then become atomized categories that you can export to other areas of Shas. So this is Rav Lichtenstein at his best. Well, now that I've given this general speculative idea with all of my sources, does halacha itself recognize it? Of course, the answer is going to be yes. That was, you can hear, you know where Lichtenstein is shooting towards, what his target is. But to contrast, he quotes an incredible quote from clearly one of his favorite authors. If I had to list the three favorite authors of Rav Lichtenstein, well, actually there are four, but I'll tell you a cute story for the fourth. It was John Milton, obviously. It was, I'm forgetting for a second. My head is somewhere else. I forgot who the third was. It was Cardinal Newman and Matthew Arnold. Matthew Arnold, his cultural criticism. Don't ask me to tell you who Cardinal Newman was in the 19th century. These are people who opposed secularizing movements in their respective generations. Alfred Newman, I think it was it sounds like that funny guy from Ebenezer.
Alfred, yeah.
I don't think that's it. But Cardinal Newman, so anyway, so he quoted him very often. The fourth person he quoted was, and I'll tell you the story later if we have a little bit of time, because it sinks in one.
John Henry Newman.
19th century,
yes.
Yeah.
Born 1801.
Okay.
And died 1890. So basically the 19th century, almost all of it.
Okay. Newman is going to say something more firm than any firm Jew would ever say. Get ready. And ironically, Rav Aaron's going to buy into it, but he's going to end around it. Of course we accept what Newman says, but he's wrong practically. So what does Newman say? Newman says basically, halacha, avodas Hashem, as we would say, the punctilious details of one single mitzvah, is more important than any human calculus. Namely, if everything out there were to be destroyed, but one mitzvah is performed, that's a better situation than if the mitzvah is omitted and life continues to prosper. A complete reordering of religious calculus. Human welfare is completely, completely insignificant when held up to divine will and divine law. Happens to be Hashem wants human welfare, but if you try to separate the two, divine law, Hashem's will, listen to Cardinal Newman saying it in the most extreme fashion. Beautiful quote. He holds, source 25, it's better for the sun and the moon to drop from heaven, basically apocalypse, and for the earth to fail, everything fall apart, and for all the many millions who are upon it to die of starvation in extremist agony, who cares? Then one soul will say, but should commit one venial sin, should tell one willful untruth, or should steal one poor farthing without excuse. A worse fate, then the world destroyed, the apocalypse, is an aver. Because, of course, if you deconstruct it, an aver opposes Hashem's will. What could be worse than disobeying Hashem's will? So do we accept that? Do we not accept it? Zervan is a chilek. Of course we accept it, in the absolute sense. But it just so happens that part of Hashem's will is human prosperity. And I could prove it to you, not just in general, but I could prove it to you by looking at the roster of halacha. And Rav Aaron itemizes six areas, which I won't go into, six areas of halacha, which he feels indicate that human concerns are not just external overtalies of halacha, but are internal to the halacha calculus. And these are, very, very, very briefly, pikuach nefesh. That's really not fair. Because even if you didn't take a humanistic vision, you need pikuach nefesh, because you need to have humans to connect. It's the Shabbos calculus. Save someone about the Shabbos for the next Shabbos. So even if you took a degraded view of human experience, you'd still campaign in favor of pikuach nefesh. It's more when the Rambam quotes pikuach nefesh, the way he editorializes it, that Kodesh Baruch Hu wins prosperity, and mishpatei tarachim chesed ba'olam. So if we have some time, I'll read the Rambam. But the other ones are really fascinating. Kavod HaBrias, human dignity. Darchei Shalom, social harmony, domestic bliss. Tsar, where halacha takes tsar into account. Shas Adchak / Hefsin Meruba. I say 6 and then 5. Hefsin Meruba. Now the problem of Lichtenstein has is that Pikuach Nefesh is carefully mapped. We know the applications, we know the laws. Less so with Kavod HaBrias, and less so with Darach HaShalom in particular. We have very, very limited halachic applications of Darach HaShalom. Essentially, you're looking at three or four Gemaras, which protect the dignity of someone's hygiene. Let's say, in theory, there are certain cases where if the price of disrobing your shatnez would be to expose yourself in public, in certain cases, if it's only Asad Rabbanan, B'Shev Ve'al Tase, it's a big machlokas Rishona, but it's very, very limited in scope.
You're talking about
Big Day Kilayim.
Right. You're talking about Darkei Shalom?
Kavod HaBrias. There's a Kavod HaBrias about removing the mace to a carmelist, the Gemara in Shabbos, which is only Asid Rabbanan. This is Darkei Shalom about bringing basically toilet paper to the roof. It entails Hefsin Ruba, their toilet paper was Avanan, so can you move Avanan in Shabbos? That's Eva. It's not Darkei Shalom.
No?
It doesn't say Darkei Shalom. It doesn't say Kavod HaBrias. This is human dignity.
No, Darkei Shalom.
No. So when it comes to Kavod HaBrias, we don't really have broad scale applications. We have very few applications, and we've shown them severely limited, but yet Rav Aaron wants to expand it. So you hear this halachic tension. He's working within the context of halachic calculus, but he doesn't have that much to support. So for example, he quotes, I'll just read through these very quickly with you. He quotes, for example, a source number 29, for example. The value of Kavod HaBrias as expressed by non-halachic statements. So for example, according to one day in the Mordechai in Shabbos, you cover the bread Shabbos morning, not just Friday night. You cover the bread Friday night because of the towel that covered the man Friday. But there's no man that fell on Shabbos, and there's no towel when they ate the bread on Shabbos. So why would you cover the bread Shabbos morning? So we all know the Mordechai, because you don't want to embarrass the bread while you make Kiddush. Kabbanishal, the bread isn't insulted. It's an inanimate object. This to Rav Aaron indicated how sensitive we are to Kavod HaBrias, that if we take care to protect the dignity of the bread, it will spill over to human relations and we'll protect each other's dignity. Or the Gemara, the Medrash about, we'll get to that in a moment. If you take a look at Rashi, just to get a little halacha in here, we don't really have a source for Kavod HaBrias. The Gemara talks about Gadol Kavod HaBrias, Shadocha Lutzeh Shabbatar. There's no Makor for that. Rashi, in Shabbos, based on the Gemara in Brachos, believes the Makor is this alamta mehen, that if a Talmud Chacham or an older person sees a lost item, and it would be beneath their dignity to retrieve the lost item, he doesn't have to retrieve it. Pav mishat ha-yachal lis'alim. Most people assume that to be internal Hashem Zaveda halacha, that Hashem Zaveda has a clause allowing neglect. But Rashi believes, as Rashi in Shabbos, source number 31, the chsiv, this is Rashi explaining Kavod HaBrias, this alamta mehen, prat lezakim meinif lechavodah. So Rashi applies the Visalamta Neham, the Pamashat Yachal Salim, as a general principle for Kavod HaBrias. Or when the Rambam talks about Kavod HaBrias, he gets into one of his editorials. The Rambam is 98% halacha, legalese, but their editorials generally at the end of each section, but sometimes he threads these editorials even in the middle. So here's an example. Hilchas Anedjin Perach of Dalet Halacha Yud, describing a judge who could be very glib and very insensitive to human needs because he's wielding authority and he should wield authority. V'chol Yehu Maisav, source number 32, L'shem Shamayim, V'al Yehiah Kavod HaBrias Kal Be'enav, Sherehu Docha Eslos Asei Shol Devayim. So the Rambam isn't really applying Kavod HaBrias to any halachic context. There's no halacha of this then. So this is more of a general bit of guidance to Dayanim. Keep Kavod HaBrias in mind. And then the Rambam speaks about it also in the Chasavelos, that if, let's say, you're a Kohen and you're following a mourner, and the mourner walks through an area which has Truma Drabanan, an example of Beis HaPras, which has certain body parts that may or may not exist, that's only Asa Midrabanan, you're only telling Midrabanan, you're a Kohen, you should follow that mourner. I think, well, I'll get to the halachic applications in a moment. So Kavod Abrius is very wishy-washy. It's very ambiguous where it should or shouldn't be applied, even more so with Darchei Shalom. Where's the classic Darchei Shalom? Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel, Ketzed Merakten L'fnei Hakala. But when it comes to honesty and dishonesty, it may not be Darchei Shalom. The Gemara never explains Beis Hillel's Kula based on Darchei Shalom. It could be, it's not a lie, because subjective beauty, and these are things that you should say. And just because you tell a lie doesn't mean that Darchei Shalom is overriding Sheker. That's just one way of interpreting the Gemara. So where do you have Darchei Shalom creating, Darchei Shalom creating an override of real halachas? The only case we have is Gemara and Shabbos. If you don't have enough money for Ner Chanukah, Ner Shabbos, you should purchase Ner Shabbos because of Shalom Bayis. In that case, not social bliss, not social harmony, but domestic bliss. And that's really all. That's the only indication you have. Rav Aaron labored to prove that it may be extant, and it may be expressing itself in other areas. And this was pretty much the second half of this 100-page article, which then became a shir klali, applying all the shittas of the Rishonim, to try to reinforce that there are internal humanistic elements that influence halacha. This comes from, and this I'll conclude, I just want to itemize a few interesting points of my own. This comes from a very interesting Tshuvas HaRamah. There was a Tshuvas HaRamah, I forget the exact details, but Rav Aaron quotes this liberally in his essay, where basically, what happened? Yeah, what happened was, there was a Ketana who was engaged, and then they pulled out the dowry, so the family broke the engagement, and then all the uncles got together, and they encouraged the father to continue providing the dowry, and the only option was to conduct the Kiddushin on Shabbos, which is Asur. It's a Mishnah and Beitza. You can't get any clearer than that.
The Ramah did it anyway.
And the Ramah did it anyway, correct.
He was afraid the husband would change his mind.
Right.
He didn't do it right away.
And essentially, it's Ramah basically saying, Kavod Abrius Darchei Shalom. And he finds all this Talmudic sophistry, maybe possibly a Beinu Tam, even though most cases we don't possibly a Beinu Tam, and Rashi, all these diukim that really don't hold water. And by the way, he was roundly rejected, and he had to defend himself. But he uses this tshuva as an example of trying to squirrel together Darchei Shalom, Kavod Abrius elements. And then Rav Aaron goes off in a general exposition about why poskim are very hesitant and reluctant to apply it broadly, because obviously once you introduce Darchei Shalom and Kavod Abrius, all of halacha could be essentially trampled. But he says you have to be sensitive to the dangers of under-application, not just over-application. Because under-application will create a type of psak which appears harsh and insensitive, and will cast religion as insensitive to human needs or disconnected to human needs. That's just the last quote here. Consequently, the failure to invoke these dispensations in any but the most extreme cases, but erode their position and popular awareness position as central values, and it will erode the primacy of these values. So that's the best I can do to put this rigorous, challenging essay into focus.
Where do you find the essay?
Values in Halacha.
It's a book.
It's a book. It's just printed by the Yeshiva.
If you want a copy, just leave me your address.
But what I want to itemize very, very briefly is how I feel this humanistic strain reflected itself in Rav Lichtenstein. He discussed how it reflected itself in Halacha. I want to talk about my Rebbe just for 5-10 minutes, and I'll just be very, very brief, but I feel this is at the heart of who he was. Number one, Torah Mada. Rav Lichtenstein's Torah Mada was humanistic. Vas Hesef, what do I mean? The Rav believed that by comparing religious systems and theological thought of other religions to the theology of Judaism, by comparing those large systems, you can understand deeper wisdom, deeper depths of Judaism. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. So there I've held up Judaism compared to Hegel, Judaism to Kant, Judaism to Kierkegaard, Judaism to the Greek mythos, all these large systems of human thought. And I think the Rav was a consummate Torah Modernik in that sense, in the way we apply it. I'll say something very drastic. Of course, it's nomenclature, it's all semantics. I don't think Rav Lichtenstein was a Torah Mada person. What I mean is as follows. Rav Lichtenstein was a humanist. He believed deeply in human beings. He trusted human beings, respected human beings, taught us to respect human beings, the dignity of the human condition. This is who he was. As part of his respect for human beings, he deeply respected people of wisdom, who articulated fresh ideas and high ideas. And if someone had something important to say about religion or life or morality, he wanted to hear what they said. to be a better Oved Hashem. He once told me that reading literature is a hechsher mitzvah for Ben Adam Lachaveru, because you understand relationships and emotions and needs, and then you'll be a better father, you'll be a better husband, you'll be a better friend. I remember this. I'll tell you two stories which conveys this to me. Number one, when his father came to the yeshiva, and his father was blind and senile to the end of his life, and to watch Rav Lichtenstein, Kibbutz Rav Aim is the area of halacha you absolutely can't succeed at just by reading the Shulchan Aruch. You can read the Shulchan Aruch, von Hind bis Morgen, you'd be the biggest bucky and be terrible at Kibbutz Rav Aim. You have to see it in the flesh. If you have real role models at Kibbutz Rav Aim, you'll be good at it, and if not, because it's just too complex and such a web of emotions. And just to watch him with his father and the care he took for his father, so that one Shabbos his father was there, he's already blind, senile, Ron gave a shir, can you give an aliyah to a blind man? We knew what the answer would be. But just to see the halachic struggle. And then at the end of the shir, he quoted Milton, who wrote a poem called Samson Agonistes, about Shimshon being blind in prison. I remember Rav Aaron telling me, I don't know if it was at that point, he said, I don't think that Rav Kahana was less important than Milton. Rav Kahana had more important things to do than think about blindness. But if I want to climb into the mind space of my father, I want to read about a blind poet, Milton, who wrote about a blind prophet, Shimshon, because I can understand blindness through that person. Here's Rav Aaron trying to be as best a son as he could, as sympathetic a human being as he could, and he just felt like he needed access to information that our Chazal didn't provide, because Chazal were involved in other areas. It's not combining large systems. It's understanding the base of Mikdash. I want to be an Oved Hashem. To be an Oved Hashem is not just how many Blat Gemara I learned, but how am I as a person? And there are other people who spoke about being a good person that I can learn from, or spoke about religion that I can learn from. What was the other example? Oh, gosh. Yeah, I apologize. I'm still very jet-lagged. But the second example, I had a third example, but this is a perfect example. One Friday night, Rav Aaron was speaking with Parshas Bereishis about Chet Adam Harishon. Everyone in the front row was falling asleep. 30 people, the whole base medrash is asleep, because it's long, and Rav Aaron was long. Rav Aaron was challenging, strange. To make it through a shir, you have to build. It's like a marathon. You have to build strength and endurance. It wasn't easy. Now, these articles aren't easy. And then in the middle of the speech, he goes, screams at the top of his lungs, and all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Immediately, 30 heads shot out. Did he just quote Mother Goose? Evidently, that's a parable or a metaphor for the fall of man, that man fell so precipitously that all the king's horses, all the king's men couldn't put him back together again. After the shir klali, all the Israelites came over, Miza Humpty Dumpty, Achor and Misha, they went to. Now, I may not know the Rav that well, I don't know if anyone knows him better than me, but I can't imagine in my wildest dreams the Rav quoting Humpty Dumpty. I could see him quoting Socrates, I could see him quoting Kant, I could see him quoting Plato, I can't see him quoting Humpty Dumpty. It was a totally different feel. The Rav was describing these vast, large articulations of religion, how the Rav Aaron was just happening to be a better Oved Hashem. And if I could quote Humpty Dumpty or quote the Notre Dame coach, Newt Rodney, the feel from which he was, I never heard Rav Aaron say this word. It's fascinating. I heard him say it once, Lahavdil. You know, people sometimes say this is what we believe, Lahavdil. He never said Lahavdil. I don't think he felt it was Avdullah. He was trying to be an Oved Hashem, and he respected human beings, and I think that unfortunately we've moved away from that, as he's implying in 1967. Somehow religious people are starting to lose respect for non-religious people, respect for dignity, and maybe we can restore some of that. Obviously, number two, Goyim, as an offshoot of what I said, or drained into us, and lack of any xenophobia, racism, bigotry, dismissiveness towards Goyim. And remember, living in the West Bank, this is not an easy statement, and I remember deeply, I remember the arguments during the 80s where some much more radical right-wing settler rabbanim. I remember, I was thinking about it the other day, the Haramite backstory, and Rev Dov Lior, who's a leading rabbanim, and everyone said it's better that 10 Palestinians, innocent Palestinians, lose their life than the fingernail of one IDF soldier be even slightly scratched. Reductio ad absurdum, which I don't subscribe to. Again, these are complex moral conversations. Again, it's better this, better that. But if you gave me a choice and my fingernail should get a little scratch and I could save 10 Palestinians' life, scratch away. You have to endure a little bit of distress. Again, they're not trying to scratch our fingernails, but if in theory that were the moral equivalency. Number three, which is a much, much larger conversation, is individualism. Israel and the religious Zionist community in Israel was profoundly affected by Rav Kook. Rav Kook was a collectivist thinker. And I'm part of Am Yisrael, and where is Am Yisrael heading, and my decisions have to support this national historical movement, and I lose my identity, intentionally submit my identity to And Rav Moshe Singh restored a lot of the individualism, because individual has such dignity, has to be conceived of and supported. So, for example, just to put it into, to frame it differently, should Pikuach Nefesh play a role in political and military decisions? Rav Gordon said no, because we view these decisions through a collectivist lens. Collectively, we have to go to war. In war, people lose their lives, so Pikuach Nefesh is not a factor in a collective calculus. Rav Gordon felt that it was. We have to consider individuals living in the country and individual lives that can be saved, potentially both sides of the fence, which is very, very unpopular. But that's just one small example, just to clarify it. But, and how we saw life and how he built us and how he built his yeshiva and how he encouraged our growth and our development. I once heard him say in a moment of transparency, someone once asked him, said, Rebbe, how come there's a disproportionate amount of Americans who excel in yeshiva and the Israelis don't have such aspirations? I don't know who said that. But like, certainly in the 80s, most of the people who were at the top of the yeshiva were either these Americans or the Israeli who grew up in an American household, Yermi Savitsky. I don't know if you know all these names. And the Israelis, they came, they went, they moved. And I think Rav Aaron attributed this to this more individualism, ambition, personal identity. Whereas in Israel, it's part of the overall fold and part of the overall community. Am Yisrael's indistinguishable parts. The fourth answer is, and this, I think, speaks to who Rav Aaron was, and I'll just end with this. Hillel, the Baskel came out and sided with Hillel. So why did the Baskel side with Hillel against Shammai? Because they were Naim, and they were kind and compassionate, and they let Shammai speak first. That's a very jarring Gemara. You're deciding the future halachic authority for the rest of Jewish history based on morality. Give Hillel a moral award, like a graduation. You get the citizenship award. You know, you get the best Haramadnik award. Give Hillel an award for his morality rather than Paskin. Paskin should be based on who has the truth, who drills down, who penetrates as deeply as possible to the truth of Torah. The answer is, we call Torah Rahmana. And at the heart of Torah is compassion and kindness. And if you're a kind person, you're not just a more moral person, you'll understand the depths and the mysteries of Torah better than the next person. And Hillel understood Torah more deeply precisely because they were Rahmana. Not that Beis Shammai warned, but Beis Shammai applied the absolute perfectionist code. So we're not awarding Hillel because they were moral. We're awarding Hillel because we trusted their Torah, because it synced better with Rahman Levi.
That's a good Raya.
And of a second Raya, by the way. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked all of his Talmidim for what's the most important trait. So one said, Shachin Tov, Isha Tov, Ayin Tov, Water Blaza, Ben Arach, Say Lev Tov. Ravaran loved that Mishnah. There's a story about that Mishnah also. And then when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai handed out nicknames to his Talmidim, what did he call a Blaza, Ben Arach, Blaza, Ben Arach, Mayin Amiskaber? Why is he a Mayan and Miskaber? Because if you respect people, you'll accept their wisdoms. The same way an underground river becomes a large roaring river by being fed by other rivers. So a small Mayan becomes a Mississippi River because other Mayanas feed them. So it's not just that you're digging into the depths of Torah's compassion, you're also listening to other people's wisdoms and incorporating that. And that, you know, every way I like to think about Rav Aaron from a different angle, it just struck me. Rav Aaron's wife talked about this a little bit in his hesped for Lichtenstein in Hebrew in the yeshiva. So if you're interested, go to Wayu Torah. There's some echoes of this in his hesped. So this is Rav Aaron's view of halacha, but this is my ode to my Rebbe, based on working very, very hard through this piece. So I hope I was able to bring it to sharper detail. You're welcome to read the article. Wish you luck. Wish you luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
You landed this morning?
We also, Rav Lichtenstein, refused to fly business ever.
Yeah.
Land in yeshiva at the age of 80. And get yeshiva for 13 hours. You can't imagine how he haunts us. You can never be tired. You can never be hungry. You can never be weak morally. Just... the standard he set for us.
I know, I'm saying. That standard was big for
him. Look, Rav Amitai tell we stored a lot of the battles, because Rav Amitai was good, happy. He allowed us to fail, but because he just called us up that mountain. The type of life
you
know,
they do any patent litigators for the.
That's why we have your Golem stories. I guess like that. I hate to say it, but it almost just pales.
Uber Mosh. I bet Hashem just.
I know. I signed back on my PhD. I just masters. Yeah. I work with.
I'm styling you. Styling you
guys.
I went for the interview in Juliana. I was sitting with Jewish agency and
Rob, Jeff Engerman.
The guys
broke off the prosecution.
So a man came out and said,
right.
You're here to see me? I said, no, I'm here to see where I live. I didn't know what it looked like.
Wow. He didn't mind.
No,
yeah. No, I don't think he might.
He was very, very humble.
Really?
And he asked me a bunch of thought questions in his Kedushin, I think. Prepared on the Rashi, the Tosfos, the Rambam. He didn't ask me any of that.
Yes, correct. Correct. When we're on. When
you just said that.
You know, we're
in the summary words.
I was talking to somebody that was in Chaim Berlin with them. A rabbi in Brooklyn. His name is Yosef Rabinowitz. He's a big Chaim Berliner. I told him about a story. He told me about a story with Rabbi Shari.
It was like 7 years.
After Yom Kippur, he kept on learning because he had a Kabbalah, he had to finish Sabbath Shimon. So I told him a story that I heard from the Lord. Rabbi Lichtenstein, after Tisha B'Av, would also keep on learning. He said, eating's not the only thing in a lot of food today. So he said, I said, have you heard of Rabbi Lichtenstein? He says,
there are offices,
you mean the bank?
It's
Mashma. He had the nickname back in Chaim Berlin.
Yeah, but that's my truth. That was his sports school,
right?
They didn't call in Jordan.
Right.
Was that different?
Yes, I did. You said it's in the Will Street.
Who was your day? Who was
great? I still print things, so like I have my office.
The Kabbalah I got from my father was he was bad because of the baby. You've got one that's far.
One floor in the whole stack.
If you get a chance, there's another really nice book called Life Steady and Whole. It's a collection of just recollections.
It's nice.
So look at the beginning. Rav Aaron has a biography. He describes his own life. Very sweet, very. And then Tova gives her husband to Rav Aaron. I was starting on the plane, but I didn't get through it. But if you ever have that book, it's Rav Aaron talks about his life.
Yeah, I don't know.
He was very shy, and he wasn't charismatic, so he never came through. But if you knew him well, he's a very sweet man, very kind.
I was wearing a t-shirt in the office today, and
I was really amazed by some of the stories that I heard. With who would in a shed house,
like this is dressed down, this is dressed up.
Very unassuming, very unpretentious.
That's why there are all those wonderful stories about Rabbi.
Correct, you don't see that.
You assume he was just some random guy.
He just had it. He just had one.
What's that?
Tell me your Bechina story.
Benji? So I go into the.
Morty was talking about the apocryphal stories of people not knowing who he was. So
here's an apocryphal story. So I go into the. What is it, WCO office, to meet Rav Aaron?
So he interviewed for the Shiva.
They interviewed the Shiva. I didn't know what he looked like. So somebody came out and said, are you here to see me? I said, no, I'm here to see Rabbi Lichtenstein.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
I know. He looks so
redundant. Some in the army made him kosher ovens a couple of times.
Yeah.
There's like a whole book of those stories.
Right.
He used to call me up when I lived in America.
You
were at the dinner. So I helped out the Shira from time to time. I still live in Washington Heights. He once called me and said, hi, this is Aaron. My wife picked up the phone. This is having this half an hour conversation. My wife's very social. I says, can I speak to your husband? He says, she says, what's your last name? He says, Lichtenstein.
Right.
My wife starts shaking. I'm telling you.
The only reason I didn't write remember sitting in Mandel's house on
Wednesday.
I was in 11th grade, and the oldest brother, Philip Mandel, says,
she's originally
Go to Sheldon.
Like
I said, why? I said, I don't know. He gave me some reason. So basically, that was the whole
preference. So you go in every day. Are you like, is that like the.
Okay, I'm going to have to get back to the jersey.
Oh, yeah, here when I talk
that's
to.
That's what they requirement, I guess. Exactly. And then
so where are you school now?
Are those two kids working out?
I'm not the organizer, I'm just the host.
I'm
here in Long Island.
He learns with the Chiel or Kahana?
No, I'm from Los Angeles. Henry learned my wife.
Not Kahana.
Those two guys are great. Oh, I think you need to do it. Those two guys. Very different personalities.
Another was a guy in Uniondale.
All Ramos is very successful.
At the end of the day, it's
an amazing start.
He comes from an amazing family. I know the Kahanas.
Yeah.
His father's a Dayan.
Yeah.
Like a real normal Dayan. His mother's a doctor. It's a very upstanding family. Yeah, yeah, very upstanding family. Their kids all go to Yerucham, so we all see them on the parent Shabbos. You know why? Esty has a lot of Ravaran in her. She speaks like Ravaran, so she probably passes it. She's really heavy Ravaran accent. Moshe Lessa. Mayor Lessa, but Esty really sounds
like that. When Moshe first came to Gush, he was a Shana Dal, better Shana Dal guy. He came back mid-year from the army. And all the Americans were up in arms. There's some guy who was irritating Ravaran Dal. And we heard this guy Dal, he's like, oh no, it's his son. Oh, okay.
I have to get back to New Jersey. I'll go to TABC now. I went to first night at TABC.
You're all over. Back and forth. You say, for one day. How long is it?
Just till summer.
Just speaking in music what's up.
You work here?
I was here. So, okay, we have
to go. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you for all your efforts.
Nice to meet you, too.
He would have loved to say, he's very close.
If I see him,
which is
probably
going
to be tomorrow.
I recorded him.
Oh, okay.
Am I sound good?
Oh,
he's
going to sound good?
Yeah. I didn't know.